Accession number 27185, reel 37.
Barras, reel 37. I was asking you how you coordinated these airdrops with the Royal Air Force.
Yeah, well, we did it direct with the chap in charge of the RAF, which was based out at Mingladon airfield, just outside Rangoon. I mean, they come in and we'd have a meeting or go out there and set it up. I went out on one just to see what happened. I got up early in the morning, because they usually did these very early in the morning before it got hot. And I got into this Dakota and found the floor covered in sacks of rice. About three or four dispatchers from the Indian Army standing around. And we took off, and the door was open. No safety belts, no seats, nothing. The door, big door at the side, was left open all the time. And we climbed up to go over up into the hills where the Karen were. And when we got over the DZ dropping zone, which was really just an open space near a village, the light and a hooter would go on. And then whilst that was going on, all the dispatchers got hold of every sack they could. Well, first of all, they piled them up in front of the door before they got there. And then when the hooter went and the light came on, they just chucked them out of the door. And I found it was very dangerous to stand there, because they were jumping around all over the place. Half of them didn't go out with the sacks, I don't know, but I made sure I didn't. And I took the precaution of standing back after they'd been around the first time, because what happened was you went round several times until you dropped the lot and then went back. It was quite an experience, and hopefully we helped the loyal Karens to survive.
You mentioned also operations against dacoits.
Yes.
And what sort of outline plans were you issuing to brigades for those operations?
Well, to round them up. Sometimes there was a bit of firing went on. They weren't very vicious firefights. With any luck, you probably catch them. Like they used to in Malaya, sort of in a hideout somewhere, not expecting you. But we had to rely on the information we got from local people a lot of the time. But a lot of them weren't rounded up, of course. It was very difficult. They went off deeper into the jungle. There weren't a lot of them, and they didn't cause an awful lot of trouble. Not to us.
You were saying that you were also involved in organising facilities for training, like rangers and so forth.
Yes.
But what sort of training was going on? Was it the normal routine?
Yeah, I think as far as could be done, yes. Yeah. Otherwise, you've just got troops sitting around in barracks doing nothing, and there's nothing worse than that for morale. So they were kept busy. I mean, they had their normal, wherever they were, I suppose they had their normal drills and they had their weapon training. Field training, and of course there were cinemas, and ENSA came out, and so I was just telling you about Tommy Trinder came out, and then we used to have rifle meetings, which came later. When teams from all over the command used to come in and shoot against one another. And then there were athletic meetings as well. And this was my job to set all these up. But they came later, because what's happening now is we're getting into the monsoon period. Before the monsoon actually broke, I think I managed to get 3 weeks leave. I can't remember. I think it must have been in the early days of the monsoon. I don't know. But anyway, I got 3 weeks leave and a couple of others. We went to Kashmir. And we got a hyped lift from Rangoon on the RAF to Dum Dum in Calcutta. And then took the train right across India to Rawalpindi, which took 4 days. Wonderful way to see India, actually. But The accommodation on the train was, for us anyway, first class accommodation, was quite a large area for two people, where you had your beds, table and chairs, a fan, and a sort of washing area, washing room and lavatory. But the best thing was this sort of little grill in the floor, where an Indian would come in with a great big block of ice and put it into this grill in the floor. And when the train started up, the air came up through the floor, and you got this wonderful cool air coming up. And everywhere you stopped, of course, by the time you got to a station, the ice had nearly melted. Mm-hmm. In came another lump of ice. And of course, you didn't feed on the train. You always stopped for everywhere and had food off the train in a restaurant at the stations. And one occasion I remember, because you always got the punkers, punker wallers. You know what, obviously you know what a punker is, but there's this, usually a blanket hung on the ropes from the ceiling, with a rope going through a hole in the wall, the other side, where somebody was pulling the rope backwards and forwards, and then the blanket would wave backwards and forwards, sort of stirring up the air a bit. And now and again, as I remember in one place, sort of it gradually slowed down, and somebody shout out, the usual thing was shouting out, "Punker Waller," you see. So the manager of the station was very concerned and rushed behind this wall place there, and there'd be a shouting match going on. And then all of a sudden, the blanket would start off going at high speed. And I thought I'd find out what happened. So after I'd finished eating, I went behind there, and I found this Indian sitting on, lying on his back, with his hands behind his head, sort of arms akimbo, with the end of the rope and the loop round his big toe. He was just sitting there with his leg going backwards and forwards whilst he lay on the floor. So I found out how punker wallers worked. So anyway, we eventually arrived in Rawalpindi, where we got a taxi to take us up to Srinagar. You wouldn't dream of having a taxi in this country going that distance, because it took most of the day to go up there, winding up through the mountain, the hills, foothills of the mountains. And as we went up, I can remember there was sort of all the water coming down from the gurgling streams and the coolness. It began to get so pleasurable. And I eventually arrived in Srinagar, where we had, I don't know whether we'd organized it before, but we organized a couple of houseboats on the lake there. You could either go and stay in a hotel, but we thought it rather fun to go and stay on a houseboat, which were completely self-contained. You had a couple of people looking after you, food, bedroom, bathroom and everything else. And you got visited by all the guys coming in boats, offering you precious stones and stuff, and laying out carpets and whatnot. And we used to go into the town and by boat, get rowed in. And they used to sing as they rowed us in into the town. And there again, we were never molested or... Nobody ever sort of made us feel unwelcome. And we used to go, on one occasion I went to a place where they were making, doing minute work on bowls and stuff. And you see these guys sitting up in a room, and they do this, and I was told that sometimes they used to go blind, they were doing it so much.
Intricate.
Yeah, intricate work. Mm. Mache. Bowl I bought, and then woodwork as well. I bought a couple of things to send home to my mother, and the chap said, okay, we'll send them back to you. It'll cost you so many rupees. I handed over my money and left, and they're totally honest. Stuff was sent home and my mother got it. I don't know whether that would happen these days or not.
Was there any sign of any sort of political trouble?
There was, yes, because there was a chap called Abdullah who was the head of the Muslim side there. Of course, as you know, it's an Indian Hindi state. But the majority of the population there were Muslim, with a Raja, Maharaja, who was Indian. So there was always bound to be trouble there. But this chap, Abdullah, he didn't. They didn't do anything to us, but they used to. At night, you could hear gunfire coming across the lake from Srinagar And everybody said, oh, it's just Abdullah, you know, some having a go.
Well, his quarrel was with the Indians, really.
Entirely with the Indians, yeah, entirely with the Indians. Mm-hmm. I suppose indirectly getting at us, because we were in charge. Mm-hmm. So if anybody could wave a wand and make it all happen. But we couldn't. I mean, even we were powerless to do anything about that. And of course, now it's been partitioned, hasn't it?
Effectively, yes.
Effectively, yes. But it's still not satisfactory to the Pakistanis.
No, all the Indians either.
All to the Indians, no.
All the Kashmiris.
Oh, no, the most important of all, yes.
They're all upset.
That's right. Anyway, whilst we were there, we decided to go up into the mountains a bit further, and we got a car which took us some of the way up, winding up as far as when the roads finished. Mm. We then got on horses and went up as far as the horse could go. And then we got off and walked the rest up until we were pretty near. We got to a place, first of all, we got to a place called Gulmarg, I think it was. And then from there we walked up to a place called Tarmarg, which was in the snow. And there we stayed the night. And I remember we sat by the log fires, blankets and everything, which we hadn't seen for donkey's years. And I think I got the soundest sleep I've had for ever since I got back from Europe, I think, in 1944. And like everything else, I can't remember the return journey, but we just had the night up there and came down again. And then, sadly, the day came when we had to go back to Rangoon. And as I say, like all return journeys, I don't remember it.
What was going on in Rangoon then? Was it running, continuing to run down the garrison in Burma preparatory to...
I think, yes, great. As time went by, the garrison was right. Shipping became available, but it was some time before the shipping became available. I mean, the Indians could go over the border, not all of them. Some of them needed ships to get home. Mm. But certainly all the British element there, and the Africans as well, all needed shipping. So that was still going on. I do remember when the monsoon broke, we had one casualty there, a fellow called, I remember his name, Major Freddie Fox, who worked on the administrative side and had been working inside a sort of tin building. He was a heavily built chap who liked his beer. And of course the build-up to the monsoon was about the hottest you could ever get. It really got really hot. You could sleep, difficulty sleeping at night and so forth. And he died a heat stroke. And, I can say it wasn't uncommon, but it did happen. There were quite instances of
heat
stroke. What
about your own health? Were you able to keep yourself healthy?
Yeah, I was fine, yeah. Most of us, if you were sensible, you didn't have any problems. We used to drink a glass of salt water every morning. Mm. And, of course, we took our Mepocrin against malaria. You had to have one, ever since I've been in Burma, I'd have one of these every morning. And the soldiers had to line up and take him on parade every morning. Because we'd learnt our lesson in Sicily, I think it was, where the troops suffer very badly from malaria.
Now you've got heat, you've got mosquitoes. Were there any other serious hazards to health in Burma, as you were aware of at the time?
Well, I got TAB inoculations. There was also the other one. Don't think yellow fever happened there. That was Africa, where I had to have that when I went there. Smallpox. You could get smallpox. So we were inoculated against smallpox as well. Typhoid. I suppose there were other things you could get, which I got eventually, amoebic dysentery. Dysentery was quite, all kinds of dysentery were quite common there. Mm. But we had to bury this guy, and I remember as I was a pallbearer, I had to carry his help to carry the coffin. We got out to the military cemetery, and it was boiling, and we were walking around with a coffin, and then we went to where we thought we were going to lay him to rest. And they said, oh no, not that one. So we had to walk across the other side of the cemetery, by which time we were all sweating madly, And we got eventually to the place, and the thought crossed my mind, so if we don't get on with this soon, we may as well all jump in with him, because it was getting a bit hairy. Mm. Anyway, we found a place, and we buried him. But I wasn't asked to take... He was a major, so he had to have a major's as pallbearers, but I wasn't asked to do any more after that. There were, must have been, other one or two other cases of heat stroke. So it wasn't long after I got back from, since we're on the subject, I got back from Kashmir, that one day I felt my stomach had got a cannonball in there. And we had a doctor, RAMC doctor, in the mess, and I explained my symptoms to him. The first thing he did was to sit me on the table and tell me to roll up my one of my trouser legs, got a little hammer out of his pocket and started banging my knee, and it shot up in the air. So he said, that's all right. So apparently this is what he did. Didn't matter what you had wrong with you, any growing toenail, anything, first thing he did was to give you a bang with his hammer, which he always carried around everywhere. Anyway, he used his influence and got me straight into the BMH, which is a British military hospital in Rangoon, which had been there since before the war and was obviously used by the Japanese during the war, I suppose. And they put me into a surgical ward because I found out that they thought I got appendicitis. Anyway, I'd been there 2 days, and in the middle of the night once I'd been down what in polite circles is called the trots. And I kept on going, and one day in the middle of the night, about 3 a.m, I could hardly get back to my bed. I was staggering along a corridor, and sister happened to come along and see me, and she put me back into bed, and they had a test, and they found it wasn't appendix at all, it was amoebic dysentery. So then I was changed into another ward, which was a medical ward, where I was to stay for a month in those days.
Do you have any idea where you picked it up?
None at all. I mean, I could have picked it up from eating food outside, and I mean, it may have been picked up in Kashmir. I don't know how long it takes to
work through,
or we may have got it in Rangoon, because we used to go out to local places there and eat. So I just don't know. But there was a ward there of all lots of guys who'd also got all officers who got amoebic dysentery, amoebic, other dysenteries of different types. And we had the Queen Alexander's nurses looking after us, who were absolutely first class. They were a great crowd. They could give as much as they got from cheeky young officers, and we all got on very well with a lot of jokes going back, repartee going on. And but they didn't. They didn't coddle us in any way. I mean, what used to happen? We used to have wake us up at about 5:30 in the morning. And they had a gramophone there, one of these old portable ones, remember, with his master's voice ones, where you wound up and put it on. And there was a pre-war record there called Tiger Rag, they used to put on at 5:30 to wake us up. You woke it up with Tiger Rag. And then later on they'd come in with a trolley with all kinds of medical stuff, and they'd say, come and get it. So it didn't matter what was wrong with you, if you were on DI list or whatever, you had to get out of bed and queue up for this trolley to have your medicine. But it was all taken in good part. But, of course, we used to have, those of us with amoebic dysentery, used to have 2 enemas a day. One in the morning, one in the evening, and you used to have to keep it for, I don't know how long, about an hour. Until you got the okay. Mm. You rushed off, and you said, with this relief, much thanks, and you rushed off down the corridor and got rid of it. Mm. And this went on for several weeks, at least two or three weeks. And then we're on pills as well. And then towards the end, you could get out of bed and then sit at the table down the centre of the ward where you could eat and play card games with the others. But I remember on one occasion whilst I was there, I got visited by various mates. And to my surprise, somewhat horror, I found the BGSO Bulger Duke came in to have it see me with a packet of files under his arm.
Keep you from getting bored.
Yes, everybody was terribly impressed to see a Brigadier came in, but I wasn't at all impressed when he left all these files behind. He stopped and chatted a bit. He was a great chap. And left all these files on my bed, so I had to work through those. I don't know. I suppose, you see, Kit Harper having gone, they were very short in the office. We'd already had 3 weeks' leave.
Yes.
So I was...
Things were built up while you were away.
Well, exactly. Mm. But I'd been back long enough to get a clearance, I think, and then I was for this. So eventually I had to have the inspection and what was known as the shafty scope in the army, where they had a look at your bowels. Rather like sort of periscope, doc having a look through a periscope. And he passed me, but he did say, I remember, RAMC doc, he said, you do know that we can't guarantee that you're totally cured. We can never do that with amoebic dysentery. So I said, okay, but I've never had any repercussions, and I guess all the old amoebas, they are so old now that they've just settled for a quiet life. But... But the other ones, there was one other one in there with the hookworm. Now, they were guys that got inside and used to hook themselves on the side of your innards and take food as it passed by. And the only way of getting rid of them was to take a pill which exploded inside, and hopefully they'd all shake and drop off.
Loose.
Yeah, shake them loose off there. And of course, they were... subject and the butts of many jokes as they took their pills and then waited for the explosion to take place. They were a very jolly lot, actually. I mean, we had a lot of fun. They were all young and stupid, I suppose. But the monsoon, I remember sitting up in bed there in the monsoon. We got sunny days as well. But the monsoon, if you were after a sunny break, it suddenly would get dark. Very dark indeed, and there'd be a clap of thunder and a flash of lightning. Down would come the rain. And you just sat there in bed watching it, because, see, we were on the top floor, I think, and the roof extended over a balcony which ran right the way around the outside veranda. And the roof sort of extended over the veranda so that the rain coming down could drop off onto the floor, onto the earth beneath, as Shakespeare said. And I can remember sitting up in bed just watching stair rods of rain coming down and down and down, hour after hour, if you got fed up with files or reading.
You could watch the weather.
You could just watch the weather, yes. Anyway, eventually I was cleared and left. I was taken in an ambulance, because I was very weak, taken an ambulance down to Tongu Station. Bangu Station. And put on an ambulance train, a military ambulance train, which took me up as far as Mandalay, and then up into the mountains, to a place which was 6,000 feet up, called Mamio, where there was a convalescence establishment. I remember lying in bed in this train, because they were all sort of beds there, looking out of the window. And you could hear the sort of clackety-clack, clackety-clack as you went over the lines. But when you looked out of the window, the telegraph pole seemed to move slowly past. So the lines, the actual rails themselves must have been terribly short. You got the impression of speed, but we didn't go terribly fast. I don't know how long it took us to get up there. And then at Mamio, I was met. I don't think it was it must have been an ambulance this time, because I was still... carried around in the bed, but I could see out of the windows. And of course it was a big hill station in the pre-war, and there were very large areas which the Europeans or Brits lived in, and the houses there had all been bussed down by the Japs. They weren't bombed or anything, they'd just been wrecked, well, yeah, vandalized, and all that was left was a couple of walls, but there was always a chimney stack sticking up, I remember. Anyway, they left the place which we had as a convalescence home. I was there for a month. And I remember fairly early on, when we were trying to get the body going a bit, we were outside, and the idea was to throw a tennis ball backwards and forwards. And to my absolute horror, I found I couldn't get there to it. Somebody threw me a tennis ball, and it didn't react to the ball, first of all, was coming to me. And when it did, I physically couldn't get at it. Mm. So...
You hadn't anticipated being so weak as a result of
that? Not a bit, no. Yeah. It really took it out of me. Anyway, a month up there, and I was as good as rain, actually, because of the climate.
Yes, who was actually doing this? were you still under supervision then, at the convalescent?
Yes, it was.
So you were being directed? And
oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah, it was all under the RAMC. It was run by the RAMC. There were Queen Alexander nurses
Quaranks,
there again.
Yeah.
Quaranks, yes. RAMC quacks, or whatever. We were well looked after, well treated, and they saw to it that we gradually did exercises and things to bring us back to full health and activity. And the climate was beautiful up there. And of course it was a garrison town as well, I mean, in the old days, and there was a regiment up there of some sort, I remember. Of course at this time we were building up the Burma Rifles again.
Were they part of your...
Yes,
field.
Yes.
How were you doing that?
Well, there was a local recruiting going on, but we did have an Inspector General of Burma Rifles, or Burma Army, I think he was, called General Thomas. I got to know one of his staff officers very well, a chap called Bobby Barber of the Royal West Fusiliers, who I met again later in Jamaica when the Royal West Fusiliers were there. And I used to work very closely with him to get them facilities and help. And he told me that General Thomas, for some reason, was known as Calamity Tom. But I never found out why, but he seemed to be doing quite a good job, so I guess that was one of the sort of jokes.
Was this General Thomas who'd commanded 43rd Division in Northwest Europe?
No, I don't think so. I think he was...
Another General Thomas.
I think he was Indian Army originally. I don't know, he may have been, but I got the impression that he'd been there some time and understood the local situation. He may have even been there before the war. But, of course, the governor, talking about before the war, the governor before the war was a chap called Dorian Smith, I think. Mm. And he wasn't wanted back by the local Burmese. I don't know what he'd done in 1940 when the Japanese came, but he wasn't very popular. I think he came back for a bit and then had to go, and the new governor was General Sir Hubert Rance. Now he was from the Royal Signals, which was totally unusual for somebody from a support service to be put in a position like that, but he was excellent. Very imposing presence he had. And he became governor, and he was very popular with the locals.
How are you getting officers for the Burma Rifles? Are they still all British?
I don't
up locals too.
Well, some officers? Of them were British, but some of them, the early ones were British. Mm-hmm. They were transferred from the Indian Army. They were just temporarily posted there.
Seconded.
Seconded is the word I was searching for. Yes. But eventually, of course, when independence came, they all had to be Burmese. Mm. And this was a stage, this is a problem we have with Aung San and his guerrillas, because Aung San, by now, was sort of very influential amongst the Burmese, wanted the Burma army to be based on his guerrillas.
Were you conducting counterinsurgency operations against
Aung San? Yes. We had to find out what he was doing. We kept very close eyes on him and some of the others, but he was the main one. In the end, he turned out to be quite, when he found he was going to, he got the job, so to speak, he became quite amenable and then got killed, of course. The whole cabinet was assassinated. Mm. That's where the trouble started. I think if he'd stayed there, although he was a communist, and we knew he was in touch with the Chinese, he was in cahoots with the Chinese, and his badge, of course, was a star, red star. It might have worked out all right.
What sort of operations were his guerrillas carrying out, and what sort of strength did they have?
Well, they weren't doing anything then.
They